My name is Mel Peel, I'm from Valparaiso University, and I'm delighted to be participating in Holden this week. And I've been doing sessions on Catholic social thought, broadly conceived, and looked at Catholicism generally, modern Catholic social thought, and then the two periods, yesterday and today, have really been focused on Dorothy Day and the Catholic worker movement. So I've kind of imagined these two sort of going together more or less, even though the Catholic worker movement is broader than simply Dorothy Day. But of course, she's the figure most strongly identified with it. And yesterday I talked about her life and her conversion to Catholicism in 1927, and then her founding with Peter Morin of the Catholic worker movement in 1933, right? May Day 1933, right in the very depths of the Great Depression. So I thought I would say a few more things about the Catholic worker movement itself and some of its principles. We touched on some of those yesterday, and some of the things that happened in the later years of that movement. But I would also invite here questions and comments about Catholic social movements generally in that period, and some of the issues that they raise, I guess, for thinking about church and society and social justice and state and so on. So, and I also want to invite anyone who saw the film last night, On the Waterfront. I'm curious, how many people here did see it? So, some. And perhaps we can make some references to that. This was the 1954 film that, to some extent, had connections with some of the Catholic movements of that period, particularly those involving organized labor. So, as I said, Dorothy Day and Peter Morin founded the movement in 1933. Dorothy Day herself, after her conversion, was convinced that because most of the social movements and sort of causes that she'd been involved in prior to conversion were sort of anti-Christian, leftist of one kind or another, hostile to organized religion, that when she entered the church, there was no way to integrate these two. And so she was kind of in an agony over that. And in 1933, she went to watch a march in Washington, D.C., of workers and protesters and others at the height of the Depression there. That was the worst year of the Depression, 32 and 33. And she went to pray at the Shrine of the Immaculate Conception in Washington, and that some way would open up for her to use her gifts on behalf of the poor, the workers, social justice, and so on. And when she returned to her apartment, actually I guess it was her sister's apartment in New York City, there was Peter Morin, this sort of itinerant, self-educated French peasant philosopher. That's how he's usually described. And he was quite an extraordinary character, and he himself had been steeped in European Catholic social thought and action before he came first to Canada and then to the United States. And essentially what Peter brought Dorothy was the idea that the church could be a vehicle for this kind of social engagement and social thought. And she was always attracted to the Catholic Church by virtue of the fact that it was the church of the immigrants and so on. But here, Peter opened up this world of the history of the church's involvement with the social causes, the ethics of the saints, and so on. He sort of announced to her that it was her job to carry out this entire task, his ideology, so to speak. It was going to be a nice division later of labor. Peter would pronounce the ideas, and Dorothy would do all the work. That was sort of the way he envisioned it, and to some extent, that was in fact the case. So essentially, yeah.
How was he remembered?
You know, that's a very interesting question. I mean, there were people in the movement, in the Catholic worker movement, who were very devoted to Peter Morin, and you know, his easy essays were always reprinted in the newspaper. And he had this sort of the kind of phrase that even Dorothy, when she writes about him, calls him He's similar to a Russian starets, the holy fool, the slightly offbeat, eccentric character who yet is kind of pronouncing, you know, truths that no one else can remember. And so he just accumulated these innumerable stories about himself. I mean, there are tales of him being invited to speak before Catholic groups somewhere. He would always travel by bus, and he would show up, and someone would take him to be the janitor, and he wouldn't tell them that he was their invited speaker. And then someone would be saying, "Well, where is, you know, Peter Warren, our invited speaker? Well, there's some guy out there pushing a broom. That's him." You know, he wouldn't do that. And there are tales of him getting. He was supposed to go speak in. In Boston from New York, and he got on the bus, and some of the other Catholic workers saw that the bus said, you know, west to Cleveland, and so they're running up and yelling at Peter through the windows of the bus. You know, the bus is getting ready to pull out, and they said, "That bus is going to Cleveland." He said, "Oh, I have friends in Cleveland." just fine. So off he went, and this is a little more on the, I suppose, slightly risque side, but apparently also, since he stayed in a lot of these, you know, just sort of, what do they call them, SROs, single room occupancy apartments in these places, and so on. And so apparently a lady of the night came up and knocked on the door and said, you know, "Hi, honey, want to have a good time?" And Peter said, "Yes, of course," invited her in, and explained what a good time was from the perspective of St. Aquinas. The saints, you know, the definition of a real good time, a life devoted to. And so one wonders what she took away from that. So that, you know, when I first came acquainted with the Catholic Worker, those kinds of stories were still very much told, and his sort of I think that was on the little film we watched yesterday too. I mean, he really was absolutely generous, and you know, anybody that would come up, he would hand over from all his worldly goods. Yeah.
And isn't it fair to say that they always said, I mean, without him, it would never.
Exactly. I mean, she always attributed. You know, with Peter was the co-founder, he was the person. Now, again, there's always a little bit of debate about that. That is, you know, did Dorothy feel, you know, the need to attribute that to him? Because in my judgment, when you actually look at it, of course, you know, she really did do all the work. In fact, even when they were supposed to be raising money for the newspaper and the House of Hospitality, he said, "Well, we obviously need to raise funds for this." And she said, "Good, Peter. I mean, what is? How are we going to raise funds?" And he said, "Well, I think you could go look to, you know, go somewhere here and there." I mean, he wasn't going to himself engage in that. And actually, another just small interesting thing on that is, in retrospect too, and I didn't think of this for a long time, but in the history of the church, of course, these are two lay people, completely without standing. But, of course, there's a long history in Catholicism of these kind of male-female pairs forming religious orders, going way, way back. I mean, you have St. Benedict and
Scholastica,
and St. Francis and St. Clare, and so on. This kind of male-female pair. And so, you know, in some ways, it's occurred to me that it was almost like they were, whether consciously or not, creating that same kind of an environment. And of course, it was also, in some respects, interestingly enough, a partnership of somebody who was absolutely thoroughly American. I mean, you know, American for six generations or something like that, with someone who brought the old traditions of European Catholicism and so on. So very interesting. Yeah. And I think I've mentioned that mentioned yesterday that Morin's program, quote program that he had, was that the Catholic Worker movement. Of course, it was going to be a movement to alter all of society, transform all values, and you know, really alter the consciousness of the world through nonviolent action. And his understanding, and Dorothy's as well, of the works of mercy. was that they were the way by which society really could be brought to alter its deepest values. There was always this tension, you know, between, of course, you know, active, militant, political, social movements, let's go alter the world, overthrow the structure, transform power, and so on. And, of course, you know, Dorothy Day was very familiar with that kind of movement. And many of the people involved in those leftist causes and so on looked on something like soup kitchens and then later the houses of hospitality and the kind of direct social services, the works of mercy, as in the old phrase, band-aids on cancer, right? You're wasting your time if you're spending all your time taking care of these immediate needs, and what's really needed is a revolutionary transformation in all of society. And I think the way that Dorothy Day came to explain that, and the movement came to explain it very much, is that these were, in a sense, a deeper way to alter the social order. That when the works of mercy are carried out, they alter the values of both those who receive and those who give. And so that it becomes a way through a sort of faith in action, faith in love, to really alter society as well as perform the immediate services. And so part of what the Catholic Worker did, I think, that's very interesting is, while of course they would engage in, you know, actions, social protests, things like that, but they never sort of let, this is one of the principles that I admire a great deal, they kind of never let the abstract cause or the formal theory overwhelm the immediate person in front of you. And I think that it really takes a great deal of discipline to do that, especially at these various times when, you know, these movements were very vital, and especially where, you know, younger people would come marching in the Catholic Worker and, you know, impatient to overthrow the entire social order tomorrow. And in one respect, I think Dorothy Day shared that impatience, but also never to sort of neglect the immediate actions and the works of mercy. Is everyone familiar with the tradition? It's a Catholic or actually Christian tradition of the seven corporal works of mercy.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I can rattle them off real quickly, but they are
feeding the hungry,
caring for the sick,
burying the dead,
clothing the naked, visiting the prisoner,
burying the dead.
Give drink to the thirsty.
Yeah, food to the hungry, drink to the thirsty, I think. And we should have a list.
Visit the sick, visit the imprisoned, spiritual.
We're missing
something
one.
With the dead.
Burying the dead.
Bury the dead.
Bury
them. Yeah, caring for the sick. Anyhow, the there are seven corporal and seven spiritual works of mercy, and performing the seven corporal works of mercy was understood as part of the way to really alter society at the deepest level, and I'm, you know, this, I guess this is going to be a systematic presentation, but that's good. You know, one of the things that happened, one of the things I was going to talk about in the 1950s, that Dorothy Day went to jail numbers of times. Of course, she'd been to jail before she was ever became a Catholic, and so on. She was familiar with that. But in the 1950s, there were the civil defense drills in New York City. And these were, this is really kind of amazing, they were mandatory civil defense drills. When the threat of nuclear war with the Soviet Union really began gearing up, then the state of New York announced that on a certain day every summer the sirens would go off and everyone in the city had to take shelter against the projected nuclear war. And that's where you get these actually now kind of funny scenes of all the kids ducking under their school desks, you know, that's going to protect them against the atomic bombs when they land. But the idea was that this was actually a law with a, requirement of a fine and a jail time. And so beginning in 1955, right at the height, really at the height of the Cold War, and this was a very strong movement, the Catholic Workers and some of the other folks involved peace movement at the time announced that they were not going to obey this law. And so they went out to one of the parks in New York City. In the first year, I think there were about 20 of them there. And of course, you know, you have 8 million people all taking shelter in the subways and everything like that. And here's this small group sitting out. And so they were immediately arrested and hauled off to jail. And there was a character named Ammon Hennessy who became involved with the Catholic Worker too, who was quite a another sort of character there and an activist. And so when they were charged with violating the New York State civil defense law and with disturbing the peace, and Ammon Hennessy said, "I'm pleading that we're disturbing the war. That's my plea." So they were convicted, and Dorothy and the other Catholic workers were sent to prison, to New York City prison, for 30 days. You know, fairly severe punishment. And she writes, of course, about the shock of going, you know, right into this. You know, they just throw right in with all the, you know, various characters who are in prison there, and so on. But for then she writes these just extraordinarily eloquent columns about, you know, how grateful she is to the Lord for she had been neglecting that one of the worst works of mercy of visiting the prisoner. And so what an opportunity she's been given to be in jail with the other prisoners and to, you know, deal with them. So it's sort of seen as a positive opportunity in that regard. I'll just say a couple more things about some particular parts of the Catholic Worker that developed. In one way, the little film we watched yesterday, which showed the you know, sort of the homeless kind of folks and the, you know, the poor and often beaten down folks who came to the Houses of Hospitality, which certainly was the case. But when the movement began in the 1930s, that's a little bit misleading, because of course many of the people then who were out of work and so on were perfectly capable, you know, industrial working men. I think you're probably aware that that the unemployment rate in 1933 was 25%. It hit 25%, which is the highest it's ever been. And so a lot of the folks who were showing up at the worker movement and then who became involved with the Catholic Worker were people who were looking for work, in effect. And there was then a very strong involvement with the labor movement in particular. And Dorothy Day, incidentally, was very widely known in all those circles. When she went to Detroit in 1937 for the great sit-in strike, she was like one of only two outsiders who were invited to come inside the auto plants, because she was so highly regarded by the workers of that time. So, you know, the Catholic Worker supported those causes, and yet at the same time, I think they never, you know, wanted to turn this into, despite the name, it was not a Catholic, you know, wing of the labor movement or something of that sort. And that's often a sort of a mistake that people have, I guess, when they hear the name and so on. There was a group that was formed, actually began in the Catholic Worker House in New York City, by a group of young Catholic workers who were very invested in developing Catholic labor action and working in conjunction with Catholic trade unions. And that organization was called the Association of Catholic Trade Unionists, ACTUS, they were called. So their particular mission was to sort of infuse Catholic principles into the labor movement. And again, at that time, there was a lot of you know, sort of tussle over, first of all, you know, how could Christians be in such sort of secular movements? How should Catholics relate to those? And then, you know, there was real competition over what kind of leadership these movements would have. And particularly in parts of New York and elsewhere, there were also people in those movements who were, you know, there were communists who were gaining control of some of the leading industrial unions at the time, and then there was also strong gangster influence in many of the unions. And part of what you saw in those who saw the film last night on the waterfront, of course, it is to some degree a Hollywood version, but it was based on an actual sort of great struggle that took place in the International Longshoremen's Union in New York City. It was a three-way struggle, in effect, between the communists who wanted to seize control of the union, the sort of gangster and thug element that had a very strong hold on the movement, And then the Catholics, including some labor priests and some of those who had come out of the Catholic worker movement. So it's very interesting to reflect on that. Maybe I'll just say one or two more things about the sort of ups and downs historically of the movement. As I mentioned, in the 1930s, it really grew very rapidly. There were up to about 40 or 50 of these houses of hospitality that sort of sprang up all over the country. And the newspaper got up to nearly 200,000 circulation. Then Dorothy would travel all over the country and speak on behalf of the Catholic worker and so on, so that it was really a very dramatically growing movement, and upholding its principles of personalism, the dignity of labor, lay responsibility. I think it's very important again to say that the Catholic worker movement was from the beginning entirely a lay operation. There were always, you know, sort of friendly priests and sisters associated with it, Dorothy came to have good relations with many of the clergy. Others were quite hostile. For a long time, she was not permitted to speak in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles at all. She was not allowed to speak in any public forum there. In some places, the newspaper was not allowed to be distributed. I came across at one point, and of course she would be invited to, you know, Catholic organizations and campuses and things like that. At one point, she was at the University of Notre Dame. She was permitted to speak, but only in a basement and with no publicity whatsoever. So she could kind of sneak onto campus and meet with people in the basement, which you think about, of course, in later years, she was highly honored by the University of Notre Dame and many other people. I think they would prefer to have that part of the past dropped away there. You know, we once kept Dorothy Day in the basement with no publicity, you know, but that was, there was this ambivalence about it, as I mentioned yesterday, and there were sectors of the church that thought somehow she was a leftist agent being infiltrated in, and the very name Catholic worker and all that, you know, was made some Catholics and some Catholic leaders nervous, while others recognized what a gift this was at the same time. She just accepted that and worked with whatever opportunities she had. So the movement grew tremendously there in the late 1930s and really had a real impact. But then the stance that was there from the beginning, but really was not accentuated during the Depression, was the hostility to war and pacifism. Now, another interesting feature of Dorothy Day and the Catholic worker movement was that they were very early on very pro-Semitic. That is, they were very hostile to the anti-Semitic movements coming out of Germany and elsewhere, and even in portions of the Catholic community in the United States. I don't know if you've ever heard of the figure Father Coughlin, Father Charles Coughlin, who was the radio priest in the 1930s. He started off sort of advocating, quote, social justice and so on, but gradually gave way to this kind of populist resentment that took on connotations of anti-Semitism and so on. And the Catholic worker always firmly opposed that. They would run headlines that would say, spiritually we are all Semites, inheritors of Jewish tradition. Again, at a time when that was not entirely common. The first time that they took a very visible public stance again on the war question was in connection with the Spanish Civil War in 1937. The Republican leftist populist government of Spain was assaulted by General Franco, and this was a classic kind of divide again that took place in much of politics in the world, in places like Mexico and Europe and so on, where the regime was very hostile to the church, and in fact did engage in a great deal of, you know, horrible persecution of the Catholic Church, while Franco was, of course, a kind of militantly authoritarian and hostile to any kind of movement that would work on behalf of the peasants or others. And he was kind of financed and supported in part by Hitler and Mussolini. So that, you know, the Spanish Civil War is kind of a rehearsal, dress rehearsal for World War II. And so many Catholics in the United States, whether innocently or not, were 100% in favor of Franco, because he was upholding the church and protecting against these vicious, really vicious, generally vicious assaults on the church. And the Catholic Worker and the Commonweal magazine were the only two Catholic publications in the country that opposed the cause of Franco. And they essentially call for a peaceful settlement here. Let us work for a nonviolent solution. Let us not identify the cause of Christ with the cause of the Spanish Falangist movement. And so that sort of got people's attention and ears up. And then even when World War II came, Dorothy Day had already said, as the lead up to it came, said, you know, we in principle, following the teachings of Christ, we are not going to support this war, even though, you know, we understand all the causes there. And that actually then caused a real split in the Catholic Worker movement, because there were many people, young Catholics and others who had come into the movement because of its social justice and other connotation, but either didn't realize or didn't, you know, understand how deeply Dorothy Day herself and others took the pacifism. And so when the war actually broke out, the Catholic Worker ran a big banner headline, "We continue our pacifist stand." And so at that point then, of course, many people left the movement. Others, there simply wasn't the same kind of support for it. And they went very quickly down to about 6 houses of hospitality from nearly 50. And it sort of limped on then through World War II. And just one more thing then about World War II and the aftermath. The one thing that they did do also during the war, though, was work very hard on behalf of Catholic conscientious objectors to the Second World War. And prior to that time, there had been no recognition whatsoever of the idea that Catholics could be conscientiously opposed to war. The only churches that the federal government recognized legitimately to do that were the historic peace churches, which were the Quakers, the Mennonites, and the Brethren. And some other individual Protestants could kind of make a case that they were conscientious objectors. But in general, the view was that, you know, it was a contradiction in terms for Catholics to say that they were opposed to war, because it was pretty clear that the church said that. So the Catholic Worker movement actually supported, worked on behalf of Catholics. And there were several hundred, I think about 250, who actually applied for conscientious objector status during World War II. And many of them were put into a camp in New Hampshire. That's what happened during World War II. There were these camps for conscientious objectors. And the Catholic Workers supported them and then helped some of them go to work in hospitals and other kind of places on sort of forms of alternative service. So I'll leave it off here. I'll be glad to talk about subsequent developments. Of course, you can imagine that the movement came back very dramatically in the 1960s. And by then, Dorothy Day was a kind of a venerable figure for many, and she had taken on a sort of aura. And many, as the church began changing, she was present at Vatican II, by the way, and lobbied on behalf of the statement on nuclear war at Vatican II, which is actually right there in the documents of Vatican II. It says that civilians may not be deliberately targeted by weapons of mass destruction, that it's contrary to the moral teaching of the church to deliberately target civilians, and of course which raises real questions about nuclear war. And Dorothy Day and some of the other worker friends who were there at the time, and this always amazed me too, whenever the Catholic Workers would undertake any significant social action, they would always undergo this very rigorous pattern of spiritual preparation, fasting. And I think Dorothy Day did about at least a 10-day fast before she met with any of the bishops or anything like that on the question of nuclear war. And that there was always this very strong emphasis that, whenever you lobby for these causes or oppose things, that you first always had to address the implicit anger and violence within yourself. That if you went into these causes with the attitude of a superior moral or spiritual righteousness as opposed to the evil others over there, then that itself was going to undermine your cause. And if you read enough of this kind of literature of social criticism, I'll tell you, that's not the most common attitude that you come across. It's a very unusual attitude. And she was always trying to teach that, in a sense, to her followers and to the movement, and sometimes successfully, sometimes not. So I'll stop here and welcome questions or comments. I'd be glad to talk about any other dimensions of the movement. What I know of the movement since her death, which is not as much as I mentioned yesterday. I'm probably one of the people who knows more about the Catholic Worker in the 1930s than in the 2000s. I know a little bit, but not as much. Yes?
Dorothy Bass told me that you have a nice biography about Dorothy Day.
Not a biography. I have a history of the Catholic Worker movement.
Oh, okay.
Called Breaking Bread, the Catholic Worker, and the Origin of Catholic Radicalism in America. It includes a couple chapters on Dorothy Day, there's a new paperback edition of that from University of Alabama Press. So I don't have any copies here, but it was a historical study of the origins of the movement and some of the things I've been talking about here. And one of the things I do think is important to stress is that there were many other people, even though Dorothy is such a extraordinary character and charismatic person, and you can never separate the Catholic Worker from Dorothy Day, really. But there were many other people involved, I think, and it was part of her strength as a leader, I think, to be able to convey, I'll use this language, convey her charism. Do you know the way that the language that the Catholic tradition talks about charisms, the gifts? And one of the things that Vatican II said for all the religious orders, for example, is that each religious order was founded by someone with a charism, Greek for gift, a particular spiritual gift. So Saint Benedict had a particular spiritual gift that got translated into the Benedictine order. And St. Francis's spiritual gift created the Franciscans. And, the female orders, the same. Each of the orders that were founded had a particular a person who created that. And Vatican II said each order must go back and recover its original charism, meaning put itself in touch with the spiritual gifts of which it's a part. In fact, I've sometimes toyed with the idea that, if you just translate this into an ecumenical context, you could say, well, Lutherans somehow, Martin Luther, if he had such a thing, had a spiritual charism there. And if this had stayed within the one church, you would have probably had something like a Lutheran movement within the one church with that kind of a gift or a charism. So I think Dorothy, Day had something of that same kind of thing. Yeah.
Could you say a little bit more about? I imagine there was a lot of internal fighting too.
Because
what you're describing is a very, unpopular stances that this that they took, and I'm sure they got a lot of heat not just from the Catholic Church but also from internally talking about what is the best strategy to did she ever have a major rival with the factions within the movement? Or?
Well, there certainly, as I mentioned, really a split that occurred at the time of World War II. Mm-hmm. And many of the people there who left became, I'll use the term, became the prominent liberal Catholic leaders of the post-war era. Someone named John Codley, who became the most influential Catholic commentator and writer of the 60s. So there was always this tension between people who sort of could go the whole way with the movement and those who didn't. There never was anyone who rose up, you know, and tried to challenge Dorothy Day. There was a period there in the 60s where some of the, shall we say, countercultural sorts had the idea that they could go in and take over the movement or something. But they'd never met Dorothy Day. As I said, she was very tough. The joke was the Catholic Workers and Anarchist Movement and Dorothy Day is the anarch. But there was also, you know, there was always, because it depended on this decentralized idea, and everyone comes in with their ideas, and you can start up a house of hospitality tomorrow, announce it's a Catholic worker house, and start going to work. There often were, you know, individual grievances and difficulties and conflicts in, I suppose, in any human community, but when you add on this service thing, one of the great sayings that many of the Catholic workers had was, the Catholic worker movement consists of saints and martyrs, and the martyrs are those who have to live with the saints. Meaning the people who think of themselves as, you know, just wonderful folks. And so, sure, there was lots of... Dorothy, she always kept these journals. By the way, her most private journals have just been published as well in a wonderful edition by Robert Ellsberg. But she would often, you know, she always traveled by bus because when she would go from the houses to houses, because the bus is the transportation of the poor. Although she loved that, that was the only time that she had alone ever was on the buses, and so she would then write in her journals. But she has these statements about, you know, sort of preparing herself because she's arriving in the Boston House of Hospitality, and she knows that it's a wasp nest of intrigue, and you know, groups are plotting to expel one another, and all that. But then somehow she would speak to them, and you know, get them all going to work on the cause, and you know, it would keep going. So it's kind of astonishing. Yeah, back there and then there.
Were there any particular orders of the sisters or the monks, I guess, who would work with her, or did she rely more on the non-consecrated
yeah.
people?
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, she had friends, particularly sisters, I think, from a number of different orders. You know, some Franciscan sisters, orders of Franciscan sisters were particularly drawn to her. But she would often, you know, visit monasteries of Benedictine orders and so on. So it wasn't any particular group, I think.
And the movement didn't give rise to another order?
No. Now, interestingly enough, in the period when they were kind of down, in the late 40s and 50s, and it really had shrunk to, you know, under 100 people probably in the whole country, there was a group in the Catholic Worker, and then actually a group in the church who said, well, obviously this was kind of, you know, nice during the Depression and so on, but what it really should do is incorporate itself as what's called by the Vatican Secular Institute, which is actually a kind of vowed lay arrangement where people agree to live in, you know, some kind of religious community or whatever, but they're not religious. Okay, so that the notion being that, you know, the Catholic Worker would evolve into a formal religious institution, and Dorothy was absolutely opposed to that. You know, completely opposed to that, and she did not want it sort of taking on that institutional form. And she always said, you know, we are a movement and not an organization. The Catholic Worker is disorganized, and they've never sought tax exemption of any kind. If you give money, you can't take tax exemption. They always have maintained their Yeah.
I don't want to distract you too much, but can you say more about how successful or what kinds of groups did find that niche in the Catholic
right.
umbrella
right.
And
right.
run with that?
Right, yeah. I mean, I mentioned the labor union group. Actually, if you want to talk about sort of sheer, quote, ordinary influence on the larger society. The greatest influence probably came from one of their one member of the movement who then became an editor of the newspaper for about 3 years, and then left the movement and eventually left the church. Michael Harrington. And he used all his experiences in the Catholic worker movement to write a book called The Other America, that was published in 1962, which was kind of you know, at the height of affluence in the post-World War II era. And the thesis of The Other America, of course, was that while most Americans by that time, the great majority of people, had begun to think that, you know, the problems of poverty had been solved, or at least, you know, at the very least, poverty was sort of out of sight, out of mind. And that's why Harrington wrote the book and said, there's at least 20% of the population in this country who are living a life radically different from what, you know, the ordinary middle-class Americans are. And he also used the phrase, our invisible poor, because it was partly the idea that in contrast to the mass suffering of the Great Depression, which you couldn't avoid, that in that era. So Harrington's book, you know, had an actual influence. It was read by people Sergeant Shriver and others, and helped contribute to the foundation of the War on Poverty.
I have a different question, but is he the one who said what we have is socialism for the rich and free enterprise for the poor?
Yes, that was one of Michael Harrington's statements. Yes, and he actually became a more kind of conventional socialist and so on. There's also a very funny Michael Harrington story, because Dorothy Day had dealt with people from a wide range of viewpoints, and so Harrington finally came to Dorothy and said, you know, I think I'm leaving the Catholic worker movement. And she said, well, Michael, you know, you've been such a wonderful contributor to the movement, you've been a great editor, you know, why in the world would you leave the movement? And he said, well, I'm leaving the church. And she said, well, you know, why are you leaving the church? And he said, well, I've lost my faith. And she said, oh, is that all? I thought it might have been a woman. Something like that. And she said, you know, you'll come back, you know, you're Catholic at heart and so on, but you've got these troubles, but, you know, hold on, you know, you won't you know, she retained friendships with people who disagreed with her terribly. Interestingly, including, by the way, some of the people who joined the military during World War II and went off and fought in the war and so on, former Catholic workers who abandoned the pacifism part, some of them came back and joined the movement in the 1950s and so on. So there were sort of ex-bomber pilots and things in the Catholic worker during the 1950s. And she never, you know, no questions about that at all. Yeah, back there.
I'm curious about how she put together the social justice with the mercy so well.
Right.
Just from my perspective, that doesn't seem to be typical.
Right, right.
And I was wondering if you could just say more
sure,
about that.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, I think it has to do, and I do think this is definitely linked to the faith element. Mm-hmm. That is, the belief that these are eternal values being served. This is serving Christ, really. And that the impetus, of course we want to alter a society and create a society that is more in accord with the mind of Christ and the mind of the church, but that the attempt to try to force that really through using power or other kinds of conventional means itself betrays a kind of lack of faith. I think that's the way she would understand it. And this also came to a head to some degree during some of the movements of the 60s too, when some folks who were in what was then the Catholic left at the time began, you know, trying to actively assault destroying various kinds of installations and so on. And Dorothy had great trouble with that because she thought that it ultimately was going to move people away from the core of faith. And I think it's just extraordinary, too. This movement is also very rare in my perception. in maintaining this deep commitment to the Orthodox Church and the social action. Because I think there's something in the culture or in you know, that tends to pull these apart. In other words, people who become intensely committed to social action, social justice, start to become extremely impatient with the church, or to move away from the church, or to see it as an impediment or an obstacle. And I think it's part of Dorothy's understanding that you never go that route. When the church seems like an obstacle, you just go deeper into it. Go in deeper, bore down more fully into it. Even when she encountered difficulties in the church, like there's another famous story when she was in a church and suddenly there was this militant sort of war-making sermon, and the priest called for everyone to rise up and sing the Star-Spangled Banner, and the flag came out, and Dorothy just dropped to her knees and went in a long prayer right in right in the front pew while this was going on all around. So that was her response to that kind of thing.
Is Dorothy Day kind of a, and I speak to her that not as a person, but as an event, more a thing of her time, or is it something that a Dorothy Day could emerge today?
Boy, that's a good question to ask everyone, you know. I will say this, that there were many people who thought that the movement, you know, was essentially a personal expression of herself, and that when she died in 1980, it would basically disappear and not keep going. There were some anxieties there and some tensions, but in fact, that's not the case. I mean, it is really thriving. I think there's something like 150 houses of hospitality. They got websites now. By the way, they used to argue about, you know, technology, for example. I guess like Holden Village. If you go to that kind of a route, are you going to get involved in international things? So that movement itself is still around, and Dorothy Day herself is still venerated. But, you know, was she a product of a particular era, or, you know, could there be someone similar? Boy, that's a good question to ask everybody, I guess. You know, could it emerge in any other setting? Yeah.
Are all the houses of hospitality independent?
Yes, I mean, there's not any central body or organization. And I should say, too, I mean, again, there are many debates about, and I had intended, I'm sorry I didn't bring up, I will bring it to the session tomorrow, I intended to bring some copies of the different Catholic Worker newspapers published by different houses of hospitality. And to some extent, some of them differ. And, you know, like I've seen these announcements now, it says, A house of hospitality, including Protestants within the Catholic Worker tradition, or something. They've got a whole long, you know, thing like that. Or, you know, some of the houses now. I mean, you do get some of this where there some people then, you know, don't like some part of the church, and so they will kind of distance themselves from particular issues and so on. But then they've got sort of Dorothy to deal with, and that's, you know, it's tricky to call yourself a Catholic Worker and say, but, you know, she really used to be our founder, but not really anymore. There are some tensions on that score. Yeah.
Well, and are there principles that the houses follow, or?
Yeah. There is a Catholic Worker statement that I probably should have written down. That was, you know, written in 1952, a kind of mission statement, but it's very broad. I mean, essentially, it is, you know, to bring the principles of Christ into the life of society and so on. Now, most of them operate according to principles of a kind of less minimal economic standing. Sufficiency is the phrase that's used, or sometimes quote voluntary poverty is used. There's a great variation in their actual practice. For a long time, most of the volunteers were full-time folks who just, you know, moved into these houses. But then as families got involved, that became more complex. Some of the houses have arrangements where people work at ordinary jobs during the day and contribute portions of their income, and so on. So there are great variations in that regard. And I was amazed. I was at a Catholic worker meeting last summer, and there were, you know, apparently, for whatever reason, the movement is thriving in Germany. So there are Catholic worker houses in Germany, and Dorothy Day is very well known in the German Catholic Church, and so on. So,
just one more question. Is there any connection between L'Arche communities and...
Only in the sense that the Catholic worker Dorothy Day promoted, Jean Vanier, is that the man's name? Yes, and by the way, she would promote any sort of, you know, good cause that seemed compatible with the principles of the Catholic worker. So only in that regard, in the sense that they would promote that. I should also mention that in the 50s and into the early 60s, the Catholic workers, she also formed a very strong connection with Thomas Merton, who you may know is sort of he was the most famous Catholic of his era, also a convert, who in 1949 published a book called The Seven Story Mountain, and he was entered the Trappist monastery in Kentucky, and for a while, you know, adopted this very, you know, leave the world and pursue spiritual truth. And then partly through reading the Catholic worker, he actually began to become involved in sort of writing on behalf of social causes and social justice and things like that. So I mean, if you read about Dorothy Day, you encounter practically every famous Catholic writer and thinker and people attracted to the era of the era. There's a famous story that the British novelist Evelyn Waugh, I don't know if you've ever heard of him, he came over to the United States and he always wanted to meet Dorothy Day. So of course he was kind of a fancy dandy guy, and so he called her up and said, you know, I want to take you to dinner at, I don't know, the Stork Club, or, you know, some very upper class establishment in New York City. And Dorothy, you know, said, no, you know, you can take me to lunch, but it will be at one of the cafeterias on 14th Street. She said, I don't want a photograph appearing on the front page of the New York Times that says, no soup for her. So, sharp lady. So. Yeah?
Was she influential during the civil rights time frame?
Well, yes. I mean, the Catholic worker, again, was very unusual because from the very beginning, they welcomed blacks. And there was one black physician who I discovered who was involved in the movement practically from the get-go in Chicago. But of course, there were a relatively tiny number of black Catholics. But they always, I think if anybody saw the film yesterday, you saw that they, you know, there were black folks who came to the movement early on, which was relatively rare in those circles. She was very close friends with what was called the Catholic Interracial Council, which was kind of the Catholic civil rights group of that era. And then the most famous involvement, and this shows you a little piece of history, is that she also became, and this was one of the cases where they sort of started making friendships with Protestants. There was a Protestant preacher in Georgia named Clarence Jordan, who established a community called Koinonia, interestingly enough, considering where we are. And it was an interracial community in Americus, Georgia, that was designed to sort of promote integration on Christian principles and so on. And they came under fierce assault in that vicinity. And they were, you know, being attacked by Ku Klux Klan and so on. And so they invited anyone who supported their cause to come down and help them out and so on. And so Dorothy and some of the other Catholic workers went down there. And Dorothy was put on, quote, guard against for the community. And she was in a car out sort of on the boundaries of the thing. And three shotgun blasts went through the windows of the car. She wasn't harmed. But that was, quite a dramatic episode. And so then, you know, some of the young Catholic workers, like some other sisters and so on, began joining the civil rights movement, and at that time, that was still considered quite surprising that Catholics would be in she actually wrote just one of her beautiful pieces of writing was after Martin Luther King's death. And she has a wonderful essay if you want to read something just very moving about that. And then she was very close to Cesar Chavez from the beginning. And Catholic workers were very much involved. You know, the great farm workers movement. She was very involved in that. And then her last, in fact, arrest of a lifetime full of them was in 1973. She went out and joined the picket lines and supporting Cesar Chavez. And the grape workers, the farm workers, and so she participated in some kind of illegal thing there. And there's a photo, of course, that she by this time, see, this was 1973 or 4, so she would have been, you know, probably she was already into her 70s, 75, 76 years old. And there's this photo of these enormous, you know, armed sheriff's deputies all surrounding this saintly Catholic person being hauled off for another, you know, 30-day jail sentence or something, and then all the farm workers signed her her jail outfit. She was extremely proud of that. Questions?
How did she observe Martin Luther King and the racial change that took place because of nonviolent self-giving?
Yes, I mean, I think obviously that the business about nonviolence as an active principle rather than a passive one was very, very much part of this. There were people writing, interestingly enough, about you know, those things in the Catholic Worker beginning in the 1940s. There was a great interest in Gandhi, who was, of course, also an influence on King and the nonviolent civil rights movement. So she was very strong on that kind of a notion. And, of course, you know, dismayed whenever movements for social change or social justice would slip over into themselves deploying angry rhetoric or slipping over into forms of violence and so on. So. I think maybe I mentioned this the other day. They did, on the masthead of the Catholic Worker, originally there were these two brawny workers, you know, guys with muscles and sledgehammers and sickles or whatever. And then at some point they changed one of those to a black worker. So it was a black worker and then a white worker. And then at some point they changed the white worker was changed to a female sort of Hispanic looking person carrying I think she's got a fruit basket or something like that in the current masthead. So. Well, I think we're about out of time, but I thank you all very much for coming and yeah.